Hello, science enthusiasts. Welcome to the Science Podcast. This is episode 24 of season one. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, and I'm the dog dad of Bunsen Burner, the Twitter science dog. You can follow his adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at BunsenBurnerBMD or BunsenBurner.BMD. If you're a returning listener and you really like the content, consider signing up at our Patreon page to help support the podcast. It's at patreon.com/BunsenBurner. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. We've got yet again another exciting show. I'm going to be talking about black holes and black hole masses in science news. In dog science, I'll be talking about the little frozen puppy that was found in permafrost that's over 10,000 years old. Our guest this week is Kathleen Morrill, a researcher with Darwin's Dogs, a massive study that's looking at gathering data on dogs from all over North America. And guess what? Bunsen's in the study! We've got Booer Wow, and we're back with stories about Bunsen. Hey Bunsen, did you hear the one about a star walking into a black hole? At first it doesn't seem phased. The black hole then turns to the star and says, "I don't think you understand the gravity of this situation." Ah! You know, because what happens in a black hole stays in a black hole. Okay, on with the show. Because there's no time like science time! This week in science news, we're going to talk about a black hole that was found in the Milky Way that is heavier than it should be. Like, weirdly heavier than it should be. Okay, what makes it weird? Well, it's got a mass of about 68 suns, and that's way heavier than most other black holes that are in the Milky Way. It also doesn't make sense. According to the theories about how black holes form from the explosive death of stars, from like stars dying, they shouldn't be heavier than 25 suns. How did they find it? The data from a telescope in China, the LAMOST telescope, astrophysicists at the Chinese Academy of Science in Beijing, they noticed that a star, the star called a blue star called LB1, was moving towards us and away from us rapidly. It was blue and red shifting. What does red and blue shift mean? When something is moving towards us, it's blue shifted. The wavelengths are compressed. When something's moving away from us, it's red shifted. The wavelengths are expanded. And what does that mean? Well, something's kind of wobbling like that. It means that the star's probably orbiting something that's really, really big. So they got on the horn and they talked to other people from Hawaii and the Canary Islands. And they both, all of the different researchers, came to the conclusion that this star was going around something that was about 68 times as big as our sun, as massive as our sun. Right? And the only thing that doesn't show up on telescopes that fits that description is a black hole. This report is from November 27th in Nature. So all of the astrophysicists that studied this were totally bamboozled. One of them, actually, Michael Zevin at the Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, said, "I never thought in my wildest dreams you could form a black hole this big." So he was confused. Now, of course, there's bigger black holes in the Milky Way, way bigger. At the center of our galaxy is a supermassive black hole with masses of more than a million suns, about 4 million suns. Okay, what makes this black hole so weird? Okay, well, first off, in order to have a supermassive black hole, it has to be made from a star with really, really heavy elements. The heavier the element, the more dense the star. And as stars age and become bigger, and especially stars with really, really heavy elements, they lose a lot of their mass to solar wind. Also, massive stars, when they die and they go supernova, they eject their mass into the, you know, into space as they blow up. And that doesn't form back into a black hole. So those two processes make black holes as heavy as the one they've discovered near this LB1 star really unique. The researchers were calculating how much of a reduction in mass lost to stellar wind it would have to have in order to be this heavy. And it's about 5 times less mass. And all of the astrophysicists kind of concluded that current theories don't support that happening. So they're just puzzled. This should not occur. So then they had to come up with some other ideas. Okay, as wherever this black hole came from when the star exploded, Did a whole bunch of its mass fall back into the black hole, making it bigger? Maybe this black hole is from two black holes that have merged, or maybe it's from two tightly orbiting black holes themselves. But it doesn't appear to be two black holes, because that would cause a different wiggle to LB1. Now, they're looking for this. The astrophysicists and the astronomers are looking for this, but they haven't found it yet. They've asked a bunch of other telescopes to double-check their findings. It's always interesting when you have new evidence that isn't supported by current theories or creates a puzzle. Scientists love puzzles. So nobody's really sad about this. Everybody's like super interested. They're like, what's going on here? So the original researchers have asked everybody who's interested and has time to pitch in and try and solve the problem. So it looks like there's a bunch of teams around the world looking into this. And that's really exciting. The more we know about space and the more physics we know about space, the more mysteries of the universe are unlocked to us. And that's science news for this week. This week in dog science, I thought I would talk a little bit about the topical pictures that have been all over for social media and the news about a little puppy that was found in Siberia that was found in the permafrost that was dated to be 18,000 years old. And if you've seen pictures of this little guy, he's a puppy, but they don't know if he's a wolf puppy or a dog puppy, like from early domesticated dogs. So the researchers that found him in Siberia last summer have named him Dogor. That's the word for friend. I find that really adorable. And the sample of this little dog, this little puppy, is perfectly preserved. Well, most of it. If you've seen pictures of it, it does look like a little sleeping puppy. It's got all the fur. It's got a perfect nose, little teeth. They're all in really, really good condition. Even his little paws. Why is this a big deal? It's probably the oldest dog ever found, if it is a dog. And it's extremely well preserved after it was cleaned up from being found in the frost and the dirt. They used a rib bone to determine carbon dating, and they found out it's about 18,000 years old. Carbon-14 is slightly radioactive. And it's got a half-life of just shy of 6,000 years. So every 5,700 years, half of the radioactive carbon has decayed. So another half of that decayed, you'd have 25% remaining. That would put it to about double that. All of the radioactive carbon in a sample goes away after about 50,000 years. So we can only use radioactive carbon dating on recently deceased living organisms. Carbon-14 is a little heavier than normal carbon. It's got an extra neutron. And over time, that neutron decays into a proton, which turns the carbon into nitrogen-14, which is a little bit more stable. So if you've ever wondering if you've ever heard radioactive dating, that's kind of how it works. What makes this sample really interesting is that it is so old. It could be kind of a cross species from when humans started to domesticate dogs. It could be an ancestor to dogs today, or it could be another species of wolf yet to be domesticated, or it could be a legit first dog species that humans had domesticated. So they're taking way more information of it, but right now all they know is how old it is. The DNA was inconclusive as to if it was a wolf or if it was a dog. As I'm speaking, they're sequencing its DNA to try and get some more information out of it. The main research team has kind of concluded that it's a halfway dog wolf. So in between the domestication of wild wolves into dogs. And that would kind of go with the timeline, right? The timeline for the domestication of dogs, depending on where you look in the world, because all of the different nomadic humans were doing the exact same thing. They all had a good idea that dogs were good boys and good girls, or wolves were good boys and good girls, and if we could, they could kind of make them work for us, it'd be a good team, are about 20 to 40,000 years. So 18,000 years is kind of on the tail end of the shorter time frame. If they were starting in that area 20,000 years ago, 18,000 years, that's 2,000 years into the domestication. That probably explains why when you look at pictures of this little guy, he does look like a more puppy than wolf. I'll have a link in the show notes and you can check it out for yourself. That's dog science for this week. Hey, we're going to take a quick break from the podcast this week to talk about one of our sponsors, for catsanddogs.com. That's 4 catsanddogs.com. They've got leashes, they've got sweaters for your dogs, they've got cat toys and cat collars and costumes and vests. They have a whole bunch of cute light-up leashes and light-up collars for your pets. It's a great little website, and if you put in the code Bunsen, all lowercase, B-U-N-S-E-N, you get a little discount at the store, so check them out. That's for catsanddogs.com. In the show notes this week, there's a link to the store, so just click on that for easy access. All right, thanks guys, back to the show. On the Science Podcast, we have Kathleen Morrow, who is a grad student at Carlson Lab in Massachusetts, and she's working on this massive dog project where they're taking basically data from a bunch of different dogs and answering questions about the breeds and behaviors. How are you doing today, Kathleen?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Jason.
Yay. I'm so excited to talk to you because this is the first time our expert is a expert in dog science. So this is going to be a treat for people that are listening that love dogs.
Yeah. And an expert in training. So I joined Eleanor Carlson's laboratory in 2017 after doing a few rotations, which is basically where you try out different fields of research and see where you best fit. And they're really great for students who love science but don't necessarily know what topic they want to study yet, which was me at the beginning of grad school.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about your specific, like your education that led to this graduate position, just so if people can get a context for where you are in your educational journey?
Yeah. So I'm basically studying bioinformatics and genetics, which is where you work with massive amounts of data, like your entire genome, 3 billion bases of DNA, and using statistical methods to draw out patterns from that data. But I started basically back in middle school was my first experience with genetics. And I actually got into it from playing computer simulation games as a kid. And so when I learned about Mendel and simple genetics in middle school, I did a science project testing the accuracy of those games to predictions I made with Punnett squares.
And So which computer games were you playing? Like which computer simulations?
I was playing like The Sims, some early ones called like Creatures, virtual pet games. So some of the games from the 90s were actually much better at genetics than games today.
That's okay. Very cool. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I don't have a lot of time for video games, but I'm a big fan of them.
Yeah, I mean, I found that a lot of the games got genetics partly right, but most of them got it very wrong. And in college, I learned a lot more about how complex the genome is.
Ooh,
and
yes.
Since then, yeah, it's really, really complicated. We don't fully understand it. But I've been doing genetics in a bunch of different species from undergrad onward, like marine grass, E. coli bacteria, bacteriophage viruses, and today I'm working on dogs.
Oh, that's so what an interesting spread of different things you've worked on. Little teeny tiny bacterias, and the phages are even smaller, right? Those are the little things that infect bacteria. Is that correct, or did I get that wrong?
Yeah, they look like little aliens. They get on bacteria and insert their own DNA or RNA.
Right. And I think that's where CRISPR came from. The big deal with CRISPR lately is there's something to do with bacteria. I'm not a biology person. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it was honestly, CRISPR was so cool because it's like an internal protection system bacteria have against these viruses.
Right. That's where that came from. And now you're on to dogs.
Yeah. So our lab basically has two major branches. One is infectious diseases and the other is vertebrate genome biology. So if it has a backbone, then we're probably interested in sequencing its genome. And just recently, we completed a mission to sequence 200 different mammals.
Random mammals? Did you have a list? Like, was it people's bucket list? Like, did you draw names from a hat?
It was a bit of a bucket list, yeah, because a lot of genomes have been sequenced, but there are a lot of mammals that haven't been. And we wanted just a wide representation across the entire tree.
So can you give me a couple of the ones that you guys did?
I think it was platypus might have been in there. We didn't do too many of the marsupials. I think tenrec was another one, a really weird like hedgehog kind of creature.
That's so cool. You guys did that for platypuses. I love them creatures. They're so weird, hey?
Yeah, so many species. Species are just so cool.
You're doing this thing with Darwin dogs. Can you explain that to people?
Yeah. So Darwin's Dogs at darwinsark.org is a citizen science project out of our lab. And it's really aimed at understanding the genetics of behavior in dogs. And people love talking about their pets and all their special quirks. And people watch their dogs all the time, so they know what's going on with them. It becomes kind of a perfect collaboration for research. We study the genetic variation across many dogs' DNA to find associations with differences in their behavior. And what we really want to understand is more about behavioral disorders like anxiety, but we're also just curious about how personality, genetics, and the environment interact.
Right. Okay. So distilling it down, you may find connections between breeds and personalities and behavior, or maybe you won't find any when the data is all crunched.
I mean, that's the big thing is people really like to tell stories about dog breeds. They're so iconic, but it's really hard to test whether the stories we tell, especially about behavior, hold true. And the way we interpret a dog's behavior can be biased by how we perceive a dog of that breed is supposed to act. Mm-hmm. So in Darwin's dogs, we don't make any pre-assumptions. We're not saying we can only enroll purebred dogs. Any dog of any ancestry, whether it's purebred, a known mixed breed, or even a completely unknown background can join our project.
That's so cool. You know, I've been on the podcast. I've been one part of the podcast section that I do is called Dog Science. And there's been some other big studies that have come out recently, and I'm sure yours is going to be just as exciting, where they are finding the occasional weak correlation between some breeds and some behavior, but it's very individualistic. Are there some really fun findings that you've found so far with all of the data that you're getting in from these people for Darwin's dogs?
Yeah. Oh yeah. So the great thing about our project is people can enroll their dog and answer a ton of questions. So we get data about behavior, some other things about like food allergies, and some odd questions like, does your dog woo-woo bark?
What's woo-woo bark? I had to answer that for Bunsen. What's woo-woo bark? I have no idea.
A woo-woo bark's basically when a dog sort of mumbles like they're trying to talk. And Siberian Huskies are really well known for their woo-woo howls.
Oh, like a grumble.
Like a, wah, 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 wah. Yeah.
Yeah. Bunsen does that, actually.
That's okay. Awesome. But then for as many dogs as we can, we also collect saliva samples and perform DNA sequencing. So this way, for those dogs, we can find out not only how they differ from other dogs in their personality, but where they differ in their genome. And that's the recipe we need to find interesting genetic roots of behavior.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. Right. So you're melding the DNA sequencing and the genes with behavior. Holy cow. Right. You guys must be so excited every day, even though there's so much data. That's blowing my mind. That's so cool. It just came to me what you guys are doing.
Yeah. And as you get more and more data, and this is individual, the DNA matches the dog's personality. A lot of recent papers have taken breeds, DNA sequencing, but then taken different dogs of the same breed and tested personality. But this is getting for each and every dog unique personality profiles.
Wow. That's so cool.
And I get really excited by these findings because I get to sift through all the data. And as it grows and grows and grows, the findings become more and more significant.
Can you share any of the early or some interesting trends? Or is it all hush hush?
Oh, no, it's absolutely an open data science project. So everyone will be able to have access to this data. In fact, if you want to download your dog's genome, if they get sequenced, you're welcome to. The data is going to be open and shared. And I want to share a couple of associations that I thought were pretty interesting.
Yay. Yeah. Please do.
Yeah. So sometimes I run associations for multiple questions merged into a factor, or often I run associations for individual questions. So one of the questions I ran is, does your dog eat grass? And we looked at this survey question in like 1,500 dogs whose DNA we also sequenced. And nearly half of these dogs only eat grass sometimes. And that's pretty normal. Every dog eats grass sometimes. But a good portion of dogs either rarely ever eat grass or almost always eat grass. And we find differences in DNA that trend with differences in this trait. But I kind of expected this trait would be influenced by genes involved in like the GI tract, because owners are always told like, your dog's eating grass because his tummy's upset.
But yeah, that's what we were told.
Yeah, so sorry. Everyone says that. Oh, why is your dog eating grass? Well, maybe his stomach's upset. But what we found was a strong association within a neuronal gene, something that gets expressed in the brain.
So that's the data's coming in, the science is coming in that there's a link there, right?
And it might actually be a behavior thing. I didn't think that one would be a behavior thing, but there might be more to explore there with consideration to the gut and the brain.
Oh, that's so cool. So are you going to be out there? Like if that comes, man, if your data comes back, can you imagine your study's going to be like all over the internet trying to bust some of these myths that maybe it's not because your dog's stomach is upset. It's just their behavior or something.
Or maybe it is both. Maybe there's an interaction with your stomach being upset and whether the dog will go after grass.
Complicated, way more complicated.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of interactions. I can also tell you about something that terribly failed. So we were looking at retrieving behavior and trying to find, you know, what genes are involved in retrieving, because that's something that we think is a genetic trait. Retriever breeds were selected for their propensity to pick up and gently hold birds and bring it back to their person. But we couldn't find any DNA association, despite observing that dogs in our study with more retriever ancestry are more likely to enjoy retrieving. So that's when we realized that we need to explore more about breed ancestry and behavior, not just look at the DNA variants.
Oh, that's blowing my mind, because before Bunsen, we had a golden retriever, and she was really good at retrieving stuff. We never even had to teach her. She just would bring it back.
Yeah, it's sort of like a natural tendency. Yeah, or even not in genes. It could be a lot of the genome just doesn't encode for genes. There's non-coding areas that we don't know what they do necessarily. We know that some of them regulate how much of a gene is made, how much of a protein's made. Some of them do other things.
Well, that's exciting too, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. And then even without any of the genetics, we wanted to kind of see if there's trends in the personality surveys with the breeds that could tell us a little bit more about what are the breed specific.
Right. And you guys found that the retriever breeds like to retrieve more. Like that was a positive correlation there.
Although that isn't as strong as retrievers wanting to eat a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, tell me about it. Oh, we had to keep food away from Callan. Like you wouldn't believe. She would eat everything and was always hungry.
Yeah, they're huge foodies.
Aw.
But yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about Bunsen too.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So just so people at home know, I put Bunsen through, there's like a million, well, not a million questions. There's like probably a, I don't know, 100 and something. Well, how many questions were there? There's a lot.
Somewhere a little over 200.
Right. I was going to say a couple hundred. And Bunsen's been through it. So that's going to be, could you share some, how did Bunsen rank up?
So one of the things we wanted to kind of look at is how Bunsen compares to other Bernese Mountain Dogs. And I looked up what the AKC has to say about Bernese Mountain Dogs. They have a very fluffy description about them.
Yes.
So basically they say, big, powerful, and built for hard work, the Bernese Mountain Dog is also strikingly beautiful and blessed with a sweet, affectionate nature. Berners are generally placid, but are always up for a romp with their owner, whom they live to please. So the archetypal Berner is supposed to be good-natured, strong, calm, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like Bunsen.
Yeah. And we only have a handful of other Berners in the project, like 45 in total, and 27 of them completed all the survey questions.
Oh, those slackers.
Yeah. Well, it's good about completing all the survey questions lets us really dive into these personality factors we find, which is a combination of multiple questions in the survey. So one of those personality factors that I saw Berners having a trend towards is for sensitivity to noise and storms. So dogs that score high for this factor are less sensitive, and dogs that score low are more sensitive to noise.
Okay, so other Berners are more sensitive to loud noises or less?
In kind of when you compare them to all the other dogs in the project, Bernese Mountain Dogs tend to score higher for this factor, meaning they're less sensitive to noise. They're a little more calmer. I could call this the calm factor.
That describes Bunsen perfectly. There could be the worst storm in the world outside, or like lightning and thunder, and nothing. He doesn't care. Nothing. We could be out in it, like out in thunderstorms, lightning, crashing,
totally
blistering
unfazed.
Wind. Nothing. Doesn't care. Yeah. But he'll bark at the wind sometimes.
That's good to hear, because among Bernese Mountain Dogs, the average score for that factor is positive 0.75. Bunsen is a 3.9. So he's super chill, according to this factor.
Oh, yeah. He's crazy chill with loud sounds. Yeah.
Yeah, and that comes from a combination of his survey responses. He's not afraid of storms, doesn't tremble, isn't anxious. So he's got that chill factor sorted out. Yeah, we can't really say whether Bernese Mountain Dogs are significantly more chill than other breeds or other dogs yet, just because there's so few of them, but that's the trend I'm seeing.
Yeah, he's chill and he's lazy. So maybe that goes together. I don't know. I was just going to ask, was there any other areas that Bunsen was stood out or was behind or right on the money?
I really focused mostly on that one because I knew that Bernese Mountain Dogs kind of shot up off the distribution for that particular factor. And I was like, that might be an interesting point to look at Bunsen for.
Gotcha. Yeah. I know there's some other dog owners that they like, if there's a lightning storm, they have to like put like the heavy coat on their dog to keep them from being so anxious and have them stay downstairs where it's not very loud, or fireworks.
The hugging vest.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm a chemist guy, so I built this firework gun. It's probably illegal, but basically it's an old super soaker gun, and I built a face shield for it and I attached a bunch of fireworks to it so I could like hold this super soaker gun and launch fireworks into the sky. And the loud bangs from that, Bunsen didn't even care. Nothing.
Oh, that's perfect.
Didn't faze him. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So you were working with dogs day in and day out, dog data and dog genetic stuff. One of the things we always ask our guests is for a pet story of their own. Do you have one to share about dogs or a pet?
Oh yeah, I do. So I'm back home with my folks. Unfortunately up here, I only have a betta fish, but back home in Maryland, I have two Papillons. They're kind of just these small, fluffy French dogs. Their names are Todd and Rosie, and they're senior citizens now, I would say. They're reaching 11 and 12 years old. I never had dogs before that. I had cats. So when I first got Todd, we had two tabby cats, and they made like a really big impression on him. So Todd would copy how my cats would jump high up onto ledges and windowsills, and it really like spooked us the first time it happened. But he's a tiny guy, so he was just agile enough to pull it off. And Papillons can really, really zoom. I'd say they're pretty athletic for their size.
My wife is going to be so jealous that you have a Papillon. They are her absolute, yeah, they are her absolute favorite type of dog. I think they're pretty cute too. And they're really smart, aren't they?
Like, yeah.
Fairly easy to train for a little dog.
Yeah, I'd say that they're smart and they're sporty. So they're not so prissy or delicate. Those are the perceptions I have about Papillons. People have a lot of breed perceptions out there, but I'd say that as far as a small dog goes, they're pretty sporty.
I don't know. I'm trying to think what they're kind of cross with. They almost got like they're border collie-ish in how they move. Like they're just really nimble little things.
I actually heard it's pretty popular in the sports dog world to be crossing border collies and Papillons to kind of get this medium-sized sports agility dog. And they call them border paps. But they do. They look kind of like mini border collies.
Yeah, with big ears, right? They've got like their papillon is butterfly in French, and that's their ears, I believe. So, yeah, super cute.
The cool thing about breeds in our project, at least, is that by enrolling mixed breed dogs, they come with fewer of those breed perceptions.
Oh, I see. Right. So that's like what I was going to ask you next is your research team, or I believe maybe it's just you and your like associate professor or something, are working on a paper about breed perceptions. Do people have a lot of breed perceptions or not as much as you thought?
We did kind of a small project called Mutt Mix, where we tried to see if people could guess breeds that are in a mixed breed dog. And people are pretty bad at doing that. And that was supposed to be our first step towards seeing if people are actually biased in answering questions about dogs based on what they think about their breeds. But it's a hard question to get at because how do you ask that in a very systematic way? But with mixed breed dogs, they come with a lot fewer preconceptions. If an owner doesn't know what their dog's breed mix is, they're going to answer without any idea about how a Labrador is supposed to act. And if there are breed-specific behaviors, then mixed breed dogs probably have them too. And it might even be easier to find where in their DNA shapes these behaviors, since the genome of mutts is so shuffled up compared to purebred dogs. But it can still be a complicated genome to work with, because they might have sections of the DNA are from this breed and then sections on the mother's chromosome are from another breed. And it gets really messy to deal with, but it's also really interesting.
That's really cool. You have more, well, I guess you have less bias perhaps when people don't know what type of dog breed they have when they're talking about what the behaviors of the dog is. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, that's one of the ideas that we could get at with that. Of course, when people participate and we sequence their dog's DNA, we do give back breed results. So it's one of the benefits of participating.
Okay, so I got a question about that. When you sequence a dog's DNA, like you have to send in like a swab or something of them, you can figure out what to a certain degree breed is within a mixed breed. Like, is that fairly accurate, or some of it like a guess?
Some of it is, a lot of it is accurate. So we find that if there's a breed in there that's in our reference panel, which is basically a set of DNA that we compare it to for each breed, that we will find it. But if the breed's not in the panel, it might be seen as kind of this unknown jumbled up piece that we can't identify.
Okay, interesting. Fairly accurate, but then sometimes inconclusive.
Yeah, and the way we test the accuracy is by basically making simulated fake mutts by jumbling up on the computer DNA from different breeds over generations, simulating the process of making puppies, but virtually.
Ah, so you don't have to worry about cleaning up poop.
Oh, no.
Oh, but puppies are so cute. Oh, it's too bad you can't have like little virtual ones you can click in on every generation.
Yeah.
That would probably add the enjoyment for you researchers, hey?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, sometimes we do get to work with puppies. We have a puppy project studying socialization early on, and that happens with other people in our lab. We have a pretty big lab.
Oh, so there are people who get to do science with puppies?
I sometimes get to help out with the science with puppies.
Okay, so I know we're talking about the Darwin's dogs. What are they? So socialization with puppies?
Yeah. So
did they just get to go like observe puppies and play with them, or do they have to like look at them from far away? Because that would be torture.
It's a little bit of both. So the way we test socialization early on, this is coming from a postdoc in our lab, Catherine Lord, has this method of testing when the critical period of socialization ends in puppies. Like the period at which they start being afraid of new things, and which means we have to kind of stick them in this room with an object that's brand new to them and an object that's super familiar to them and see whether they'll investigate the new object or if they'll go hide near the familiar thing. And it could be really sad because if they want to really be near people and you got to just stay back and videotape them and don't let them know that you're in the room.
Oh, that would be so hard.
But you can play with them as much as you want before and after.
Oh, okay. There you go. That's cute. Maybe that's why Bunsen, there, one of his, one of the videos that went viral with Bunsen and like made us realize there's something here with him as a social media star was, like we gave him a lemon and he just went mental.
I saw that video.
Did you see that one?
Yeah.
It's so cute.
Puppy Bunsen is so cute.
Oh man. He was, if we had known he was going to be a thing, like he is a thing now, we would have taken way more pictures and videos. Like we were just happy to have this little guy and he was so cute. And yeah, I'm so glad I took that video though. It's adorable. A vet said it's predator inspection. A lot of the animals do when there's something unfamiliar that could be a threat.
We actually got to go up and study wolf puppies for a few weeks in Quebec, who are actually going to be a bit different than.
You went up to Quebec and got to do the same kind of thing with wolf puppies?
Yeah, I can't really know. None of us really know the results of that yet, but it was basically to compare them to the dog puppies and see if there's a difference in that early critical period of socialization. They were so cute and they were so much higher energy than dog puppies. Oh boy.
Oh, really? Like, did you get to interact with them, or because they were wolves, you had to be less hands-on?
Oh, we got to be quite hands-on because we also needed to collect saliva samples and pee samples from them after the test. So we hung out with them a lot.
You know, you probably have in places, extremely demanding job crunching all the numbers and the data, but that must just be highlights of your months.
Yeah, it totally is.
With Darwin's dogs, which breed do you have the most information about? I'm just curious about that. If people are self-reporting, which one do you have the most information?
By far, the most information we have is from Labrador Retrievers. But we also have info from German Shepherds, Goldens, Border Collies, Chihuahuas, poodles, and American Pit Bull Terriers. We actually need more small dog breeds. That's something we're lacking a bit in the study. So shout out to small dogs.
Yeah, you bet. When this podcast airs, I'll put a link in the description. And there's a ton of dogs that follow Bunsen on Twitter. How long does this go for? Like your collection of data?
This project will go on forever as far as we're concerned, because there's no reason it shouldn't. Collect more and more information. And the survey data can tell us a lot more about the dog population. So basically enrolling and answering these questions, you're already helping out science.
Gotcha. So yeah, we'll tweet out about that when the podcast airs and get some of the little dogs that follow Bunsen on it.
Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah.
I'll tag Matt with We Rate Dogs and maybe get him, because he's got a huge megaphone. We'll see. We'll see. He's a busy guy.
I love that page.
Isn't it great? It's so wholesome. It's just the best. Yeah. So one of the things we ask our guests every podcast interview is for something called the super fact. And the super fact is something, you know, that when you tell people about it, it just like blows their mind. Do you have a super fact you could share with us?
I do. And it's super relevant. I didn't know this when I joined the lab and learned a little bit more about dogs, but the vast majority of dogs in the world, like 75% of dogs worldwide, aren't from any breed at all. They're not even mixed breed dogs. These dogs are so far removed from modern purebreds that their ancestry, when we try to match their DNA to breeds, it just looks like a jumble of tiny random matches. And these dogs, people call them village dogs. They don't have human owners. They just live near people. They scavenge for food. They breed freely. And despite being spread across every continent in the world, village dogs look very similar to each other. And you could even say that they're the natural prototype for dogs in their appearance and behavior, because without humans doing any intense selective breeding, they're kind of just surviving on their own and they have to adapt to their environment. And that's 75% of dogs in the world. They aren't the dogs we know as pet dogs.
Okay, so I was lucky enough to take a group of kids to Costa Rica for a marine biology trip. So the dogs that were like just out and about in the villages there, that's the type of dog you're referencing? Like these, I don't know, the kids called them homeless dogs.
It's true.
Yeah, like there was no other way to describe them. They weren't owned by anybody. The people in the villages, they didn't really like the dogs, and they warned the kids that they could get snippy. But the kids felt so bad for these dogs that they were always trying to feed them. And it was like a constant headache for us as chaperones. Like, no, you can't feed the homeless dog your French fries. Like, no, you can't give him your mango. Like, leave it alone. And then they just keep following the kids they knew were easy marks. It was pretty funny. So those are village dogs?
Those are village dogs. And they will find those French fries and mangoes after you toss them out in the trash. So they know how to survive. They live near people. They're very different than wolves. And those are kind of what the natural dog looks like.
Right. So in the evolution of a dog from a wolf to what we know today, those early wolf types that were less scared of humans, do you think there's a link to those types of early dogs with the village dogs we have now?
I wouldn't say there's a direct lineage link. But the thing is, they look similar.
Because I'm just so interested in dog history. I know that's... one of the things they say is that the researchers are like, yeah, there's some dogs didn't have as much stress hormones or adrenaline. So they weren't as skittish around humans, and they became like the garbage patrol or the sanitation squad and cleaned up after humans. And it was way easier to eat garbage than to go hunt for food.
No, that's exactly the theory that dog evolution people have now, is this idea that there was that fear reduction. Dogs could get closer to people without fleeing, which means that they can just hang out around the garbage bins. And then that presents an opportunity for dogs to evolve even further.
Right. One gets snatched by human goes home, one that's even less or even a little more friendly, and boof. Now you've got a dog that you can start selecting for specific traits.
Exactly.
Wonder, you know, I look at Bunsen and I'm like, where did he come from? Because like Bernese Mountain Dogs have such striking features. Really, all dogs have such striking features, right? Like, it's the marvel of natural selection and selective breeding is just, it boggles the mind because of how different all the different dogs look that we made these different dogs, right? All of these different dog breeds were shaped by humans, except for those village dogs.
Yeah, so I mean, dogs have the most visual diversity of any species, really. The size and shapes and colors and behavior. And it all came from whatever those early dogs were and however they came about.
Yeah, some kind of like polar bear, teddy bear for Bernese Mountain dogs. Some kind of something like that. Yeah. I got a question before we kind of get to the end. It just came to my head. I don't know if you can answer it. I'm trying to remember if there are specific questions about health. Do you look for any kind of like traits that, or health issues in dogs? Like some breeds are quote unquote more susceptible to hip issues or cancers.
So we really want to ask health questions. We haven't launched our health portal yet, which will be kind of separate from the behavior questions we do. We do ask about food allergies. And we do have other projects about cancer in dogs that are run more by a veterinarian in our group. But we want to ask those questions eventually. We want to do it in a way that we're not alarming people with data about their dog's health. Because like people might make decisions, health decisions based on those results. And we don't know enough about how genetics shape health to say anything super confidently yet.
Okay. I would be interested in that. But again, I think you'd need, like you said, you need like so many applicants to go in and give their information. So
yeah, but it's something we definitely want to do. And we do plan to release a health portal to get at some of those questions.
Oh, very cool. That's one of the things I was talking about on a couple podcasts ago is there's not a lot of information about, well, people say certain dog breeds are susceptible to some things. A lot of it's anecdotal. There's not a lot of like data on it. So when you read books about different dog breeds, you might, see like Bernese Mountain dogs, for example, if you read a lot of the dog books that have all the different dog breeds, they are more susceptible to, cancers like they're. So that's one of the things we were really worried about when we were looking at a Bernese Mountain dog.
The cancers and the bone issues, it happens with a lot of the bigger breeds too. I actually heard about a project called the Bernese Mountain Dog Vitality Project, which is trying to outcross the Bernese Mountain Dog and then cross it back in. And the goal is to increase the longevity of Bernese Mountain Dogs because there are a lot of breeds that have specific health issues. And that's kind of how the research community got interested in dogs to start with, is here's a lot of purebreds that are suffering from this disorder and some purebreds that aren't. Can we find stuff that's similar to human disease? Apparently we can.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, we would love our dogs to live for as long as possible. So I'm glad there's scientists that are working on that. Yeah. And you know what? That's so cool. You guys are taking all that information about behaviors and their genetics information. Okay. So the paper, you guys are writing a paper. Are you going to be drawing any conclusions for publication soon? Or is it just still gathering data right now?
We are going to draw some conclusions. So Jessica Heckman, a veterinarian postdoc PhD in our lab, is doing a lot of the work on the personality surveys and seeing if there are breed-specific behaviors. And I'm doing more on the genetics end to see if we can better map the ancestry of dogs and find like which chunks of DNA did each dog inherit from different breeds. And that'll help us combine the two and get at both angles.
Very cool. Do you know when that's going to happen, or is that still in the future?
Right now, I'm mostly stuck on determining the ancestry locally. So we can get a good idea of what percentage of each breed a dog is. But what we really want to do is say where to where on the DNA, on the chromosomes, is each breed for each dog. And that's a little harder of a challenge. So I've run into some computer issues, some computational issues there that I'm trying to overcome, and I'm getting really close. As soon as that happens, I will get on writing.
Oh, no rush. I was just curious. I think a lot of people who follow Bunsen they love dogs, and it's one of the reasons why in the podcast we started a section called Dog Science, just because people want to know more about dogs, and this is going to be so great for people to hear because it's an entire interview with somebody who knows about cutting edge stuff that's happening with dogs. That's so cool. Can people find you on social media?
Oh yeah, I can plug both. I'm trying to become more active on social media. I'm Kathleen Morrill, and my Twitter handle is @Tablooza, TABBLOOZA. ZA. And that handle is kind of a nod to my childhood tabby cats. And the project itself you can find at darwinsark.org. Darwin as in Charles Darwin, and then ark as in big ship. And you can place your dog on the waiting list for free DNA sequencing, which gets funded when we have grant money. Or you can fund your dog's sequencing actually through donation, because we launched Darwin's Ark as a nonprofit to kind of help along the research. But the survey questions alone help us immensely with understanding the dog population.
Yeah, and they're really fun to do. So if you've got a dog and you're listening, head to that link, and we'll make sure there's a link in the description of the podcast. And there's a lot of questions, yeah. But I love doing them because, like, you know your dog, and it's really fun to think about what their behaviors are. And you're like, oh yeah, that's, you know, there's some annoying things that Bunsen does. And I'm like, okay, they had that on the survey. Somebody thought of that annoying thing that dog does. And then there's some things that Bunsen does that I'm just so proud of. And I was like, oh yeah, he's so good at this. And it was so fun to do the little, it was really enjoyable. I stayed up till like 2 o'clock in the morning on a school night doing that. And I was like so tired the next day. I got addicted to do it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I got addicted to doing all the questions. So yeah. Yeah. Make sure you head to that link, folks, if you're listening.
Well, thank you, Jason.
Yeah. Is there any other organization you'd like to plug before we close?
Well, we work a lot with the International Association for Animal Behavior, the IAABC. And they helped us out a lot with some of the more quirky questions about dog behaviors. And they're a great organization to follow. They have great advice on animal behavior from dogs to cats to snakes. So I think they're good people to follow.
Awesome. The one question I didn't see on there is, or maybe I missed it, was does your dog roll in like coyote poop? Because that's something that makes me crazy about Bunsen. I got to like watch him on a walk, because you'll find that wherever we go. It's so...
I was going to say, that's very specific.
Oh, it's so annoying. It's probably Bunsen specific. Like, oh.
Dogs live in a scented world. Like odor is the way they see the world in some way.
It is. Yeah, I know. And I've read a whole bunch of different studies trying to explain why they would do that. And people have some really good theories. It's just annoying. And he's huge. He's a huge dog. And yeah, and giving him a bath, he's really chill giving him a bath, but we got to haul him to, he's too big for our bathtubs. We got to haul him to town. It's a whole thing.
He probably thinks he smells great.
He does. He's proud of himself. He's like, oh, this is great. Don't you, isn't this awesome? And no, nobody wants to be around you. And of course he's like, he likes to cuddle at night, so he'll come over and try and smush into you, and he just reeks. So
that's awesome.
Okay, well, you know, this has been a really interesting discussion and a fun one, and I hope you guys just get some amazing data from this, and everybody who's listening signs up. Like, we hopefully get more people sending your way to sign up and take the survey about dogs. I'm gonna put Bunsen on that waiting list for sure to get his DNA in there, just because I think that's really interesting. So thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
Thank you again, Jason.
I guess we'll keep listening and waiting for any more information you folks find. No rush. We're just really passionate about dogs.
We're an open science project. We try to share blog posts on our website, also on Twitter. So we want to keep everyone on the loop and how their dogs are helping us.
Yay! Yeah.
All this cool genetics research.
Yay. Dogs are so good. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Take care. Hey, we just want to give a big thank you to our new partner, Genius Lab Gear. And they're offering you guys, our listeners, 10% off their PhD emotional support dog bandana. They're sending Bunsen one. It's adorable. And their pocket chemist walled size molecule stencil. It's amazing. It's like this little metal card thing that you can draw stuff with. And their entire collection of science-themed stickers. And they've got one that's really cute, really, really popular, Science is for Everyone sticker, kind of like with a rainbow font. If you use the code BUNSEN10, that's BUNSEN10, like 10, you'll get 10% off everything at geniuslabgear.com. Genius Lab Gear is a new startup working to make research labs more enjoyable for scientists and create fun gear for scientists along the way. We'll have a link in the show notes to this podcast episode. It's time for Woo or Wow. In this section, I'll be reading three statements. Two of them will be woo, they will be fake, and one of them will be wow, a true statement. Today, the theme is black holes. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, here are the three statements. The first statement, black holes suck you into them because of their strong pull of the event horizon. Statement two, if you get too close to a black hole, you will be turned into spaghetti as you stretch out towards the center. And statement number three, a black hole can easily rip apart a star. Okay, a recap on the three statements. Statement number one, black holes suck you into them with their immense gravity from the event horizon. Statement number two, if you get too close to a black hole, you will be pulled into spaghetti as you stretch towards the center. And statement number three, if a star gets too close to a black hole, it could get pulled apart. Which one is true? Which ones are woo? Okay, let's take a look at the second statement. If you fall too close to a black hole, or if you got too close to a black hole, there's been a long-standing theory that you would be pulled, your feet would stretch towards the singularity, and the rest of your body wouldn't as much because you're further away from it, and you would stretch out like spaghetti. However, new research kind of says that's not really what would happen to you. That's not how you would die. Like if you were just floating in your spacesuit, is that the quantum effects would cause the event horizon to act like a wall of fire from the energy and debris that's there. So as soon as you got too close, you'd hit this wall of fire and then you'd just get incinerated. This was actually proven with one of the new pictures of the black hole that made the rounds on Twitter and on all kinds of social media. It shows the immense fireball and red, angry outline that a black hole has. Quantum effects. I don't know which one would be better, getting incinerated instantaneously or pulled into a long piece of spaghetti. All right, that leaves two statements left. One statement is you get sucked into a black hole because of the strength of the event horizon. And the other one is that a star could get torn apart by getting too close to a black hole. The fake statement is the sucking statement. Black holes don't suck. Black holes don't. Sucking is caused by something pulling you into a vacuum. And a black hole is not a vacuum. It's an immense, dense area that actually causes space to dip. Kind of like a hole. Kind of like a black hole. And objects fall into them. They pass the event horizon, which is kind of like the edge of the dip. And then once you pass the event horizon, well, that's a ride you're not getting off of ever again. So that leaves the true statement being stars being torn apart by a black hole. That's absolutely true. Black holes can wick off the layers of a sun. If a star gets too close to a black hole, it can actually rip it apart as it, you know, starts to orbit around a black hole. And all of that debris and all of that energy will eventually make its way to the black hole and fall into the dip, fall into and past the event horizon. It doesn't get sucked, it orbits. That's been Woo or Wow for this week, Black Hole Edition.
Wow! Hello, everybody. It's time for Story Time with me, Adam. So, today, we're doing Story Time. Like I said last week, I'm going to start off with a pretty funny story, alright? So Bunsen sometimes gets really hyper. Like, if he sees a lemon, he'll get hyper just because he wants to fight the lemon, right? If I start running around the house, Bunsen starts chasing me, and we have a fun time. Yay. Now I figured out that he's much faster downstairs.
Because there's carpet downstairs.
So what I do is I take him downstairs and I just run around in circles and he runs around in circles. And yeah, it's a fun, jolly time. But today, I stubbed my toe and my toe really hurts now.
Is that because he was chasing you?
Yeah, he was chasing me and I stubbed my toe on the couch down there.
That's terrible. That's the worst story. But actually, it's a good story because you get to play with Bunsen. What I love about Benson when he plays Chase is our old dog, our old golden retriever, Callan, what she would do is just run right after you. But Benson is able to figure you out, and he's able to plot probably two thoughts ahead. So if I bet if Benson played chess, he would do really, really well because he can outthink. And so we have my 5-year-old niece, Ellie, and she would come over and she'd run around the island. And Benson, what he would do is he'd be like, whoa, and then he'd plant because he, his body is very good at like planting and stopping, and then he'd deke her out. And so that's a super cute story about Benson.
I think though you bamboozled Benson today. When you hucked the giant Costco stuffed teddy at him, there's like a, there's like a five, I don't know, Chris bought this giant Costco teddy bear thing and it's 5 feet tall, and Adam heaved it at Benson, and Benson didn't know what to do about it.
Yeah. Dad, do you have a story about Benson?
Sure. So we got a new podcast sponsor, and the podcast sponsor is Genius Lab Gear. There's already an ad for it in the podcast, but anyways, they sent some stuff like a bandana for Benson to wear. And I took him to my school and I had to do a bunch of different poses with him in his bandana. And that was really fun. That's my story. Is I took him to my school. I put him in my lab coat, put him with some safety glasses. And he's gotten to the point where he knows that if he puts on the lab coat, he gets treats. So he's totally okay with it. And then I can tell him to do paws up, and then he'll jump up on top of a science counter, and so we can take some really funny pictures with him. You've probably seen some of the pictures with him in his lab coat and his safety goggles, and yeah, I guess he's just pretty well trained to do that. The one thing he doesn't really like to do is hold stuff in his mouth, so we're working on that, and I've been working all week and for a couple weeks with him moving stuff, and he's getting better, but he only moves it when I clap. It's probably really funny seeing me do it, but he like will pick up something now and move it. And whereas before that was something he kind of struggled with. We probably talked about in doggy training, he didn't do well at that either when it was time to test, unless it was garbage. He was really good at picking up garbage.
Yeah, I remember that. And he almost failed, but I said, hey, can we try the toilet paper rolls? And he picked them up and put them back in the bin. So that was lucky.
Yep, so that's my story, taking my dog to the school and dressing him up and taking pictures.
Okay, so I think that's the end of the story time with Adam for this week. Next week, hopefully, we're doing the mailbag. And yeah, see you next time.
Well, that's the end of this episode. If you are a repeat listener, thank you so much. And if this is your first podcast, thanks for sticking with it to the end. The first season of the Science Podcast is coming to a close next episode, episode 25. And we couldn't have done what we did this year without our patrons on Patreon. So I'd like to give a quick shout out to our top tier patrons. Andrew Persons, Liz Button, Ben Rathert, Bianca Hyde, Chris Hemholt, Elizabeth Bourgeois, Karen Beth St. George, Kathleen Zucher, Marianne McNally, and Carmen Preciado. Thanks, guys. Also, I'd like to give a big thanks to our guest this week, Kathleen Morrow with Darwin's Dogs. You'll find a link to Darwin's Ark, the website, where you can log in and set up your own account for your dog for the study, in the show notes. I'm just so excited for next week's episode. I've been working really hard to gather a bunch of dogs of Twitter and interview them with some questions. And man, are the interviews so good. Who knows, maybe next episode might have to be split into two because the interviews were so powerful with all the owners of the different dogs of Twitter that I was able to get a hold of. I can't wait to share that with you guys. So let's close the second last episode with Benson's motto. For science, empathy, and cuteness.